he's not dead, he's surely alive. He's living on the inside, roaming like a lion.
I'll tell you how God's not dead pilled I am. I actually went and downloaded the app that they advertise at the end of the movie. I don't know if you guys can see that, but I've got it right here. I am a little disappointed by it, frankly. Hell yeah.
I was just walking my dog and downloaded it, and then I was like, this sucks.
It's not a good app, you know, even by the standards of this kind of thing. It's basically just plugging, yeah, like the movies and the books, which apparently, I guess, what are their novelizations of these? I'm sure those are great.
There's only one book I need, and it's The Good Book, so I don't know what they're doing there.
No, they're not. They should be novelizations, but they're all like the evidence behind God's Not Dead, which you're like, you don't need that.
That's great. I love that there's a whole series of like secondary reading, you know? It's like this is what evangelical fan culture is. It's just like regular fan culture, but it's like look, here's the tabulation of evidence that the Christian God is the one true God and is scientifically provable to be real.
Can I show you guys my favorite app on my phone? It's the Richard Roper app. It hasn't been updated in a few years, but when it loads, there's a picture of the Chicago skyline. It may not actually load anymore. There may not be any reviews on there. Last time I checked, the most recent movie was Deadpool.
What does it do, or what did it do in its heyday?
It was a one-stop shop for all of Roper's reviews. Like, you'd go to his Chicago Sun-Times articles, where he was also the critic. He was the film critic at the Chicago Sun-Times, if you want to know why fucking print media is dying. But then it would also go to his YouTube channel, where he'd do skits in his reviews, too. Like, sometimes he dresses the characters. So, I don't know, it was a great, you know, awesome app for a couple of years there, a couple of weeks probably, but yeah.
Well, so you'd have to be pretty Roper pilled though to enjoy that. It reminds me of I believe at one point there was a Jeremy Renner based app. Oh. So like an app that was entirely like a Jeremy Renner thing, and the selling point of that was that you could, I think, pay real money for a sort of like in-game currency, as it were, that would like not necessarily let you interact or talk to Jeremy Renner, but like would make your comments go to the top, which would then increase the possibility that Jeremy Renner might talk to you.
It's funny because like Jeremy Renner is the level of fame where it's plausible that he would have an app, but then also to have institute a system like that where you're sort of bartering for a chance at Jeremy Renner seeing you. He's not that famous. He's not famous enough to earn that. Like, maybe Taylor Swift is famous enough to have that.
He would release his music on it, too, I believe.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and he would send you notifications like, Happy Ren's Day.
That's kind of sweet. I feel kind of bad for how much we all made fun of him for that app now. And now that he's, like, narrowly survived death, too, I think we got to let him out of jail.
All right. Well, a bit of an informal start to this one, but you are listening to Michael and Us. As always, I'm Luke Savage, and with me, also as always, is
Will Sloan. Hello.
And with us again for another foray, our third to date, into the incredible evangelical film series God's Not Dead, is our God's Not Dead correspondent, Alex Shepard of The New Republic. Welcome back, Alex.
It's great to be back. I love doing these. I love talking about these wonderful films.
Well, it's an honor, and sometimes we're reluctant to have guests on because we think, oh God, do we want to put them through a bad movie? You know, the format of the show is sometimes too much to ask of a guest. Knowing that you like these movies, knowing that you're enthusiastic, I mean, if they keep making them, we'll keep having you on.
Well, there sadly has not been one since 2021, so we might be, I guess we're probably due for a fifth installment in the franchise at this point, but...
Well, as I understand it, you know, the films have done progressively worse at the box office, so one of the things that was striking, Alex, when you and I first talked about the first film, which, you know, Will actually still hasn't seen, although he was telling me that having listened to the episode and seen two others, he feels like he's seen it.
I actually have a bit of Cavanna syndrome with that movie, where it's like you were talking about Kevin Sorbo and his girlfriend who like doesn't believe, and then they go to an intellectual party where they're all listening to classical music and he's like quoting Nietzsche or something. It's like, I could have sworn I saw that movie, but like, no, I haven't.
Well, this in fact may be the Mandela effect. There may be a parallel dimension in which you actually did see the movie and Alex wasn't the only other co-host on that episode. And I bring up the Mandela effect because it plays a significant role in the film that we watched this week. We will get into that in a moment. But Alex, one of the things that struck me when you and I talked about the first film was, yeah, obviously I'd never heard of it, but, you know, it's a movie that, like certain evangelical films, you know, they have their own film industry. Some of the films do very well. They make tens of millions of dollars or more. I believe by the time God's Not Dead 2 had finished its run at the box office, the series had netted something like $90 million or something unbelievable like that. The third film, which we will be discussing today, did not do quite as well, and I think the fourth film did even worse. So I hope that that diminution does not deprive us of the fifth God is Dead film that, you know, we all want and deserve.
God's Not Dead. Excuse me. How dare you? I see the globalists have gotten to you too.
Someone who's not paying attention to the Newsboys ending. Or you're instructed to tweet with the hashtag.
Yeah. Do you want me to text you God's Not Dead right now?
I need to get your number so I can just start randomly texting you this.
Well, I think I could be mistaken, but I think the God's Not Dead app has some kind of like it has, since I downloaded it last night, it sent me various entreaties to like contact my family or like use like some kind of family tie-in feature to text people God's Not Dead. So maybe the three of us can actually connect on there. Maybe we can have like a God's Not Dead app based DM.
Unfortunately, what I just am realizing is that there was some sort of God's Not Dead event at NYU yesterday, or possibly even earlier today.
What?
Yeah, I just searched the hashtag and somebody named Rice Brooks, who I guess is Dutch and a grain enthusiast, tweeted hashtag God's Not Dead event at NYU is a special one. Some organization of evangelicals, every nation campus, NYC, has tried for years to have this event there, and their perseverance paid off. And it is a full house to watch the first God's Not Dead movie.
Wow. So, yeah, the pernicious forces of secularism at NYU, they tried to stop this event happening for years, and belief has finally triumphed. I mean, if nothing else, you know, it's a timely reminder that God's Not Dead is not just a film series, it's a movement. I was planning, as we've done on other episodes, Alex, where you've joined us, of talking about some other stuff, but I feel like the three of us all have God's Not Dead 3 on our minds, and we might as well just get into it. So, I don't know, where do we begin with this one, fellas?
Sometimes all it takes is a spark. The spark becomes a flame, and if that flame spreads, it transforms everything around it.
All these years, this church has been here. Now it's the crime scene.
What's gonna happen when I find him?
Put him away, I hope, for a long time.
Has brought nothing but controversy to the school for years.
What's the church doing on a state campus in the first place?
This was my father's church, and it's not for sale.
How do we actually know that our values are any more valid than anyone else's?
God called me to fight.
God calls you, you call me.
His brother is a lawyer. Are you kidding me?
What you're doing, it's against the law.
We're wasting our time here.
We cannot respond to hate with more hate.
Is it true?
The full title, by the way, is God's Not Dead, A Light in the Darkness. And I was disappointed by this movie. God's Not Dead 2 was one of the funnier bad movies we've watched on the podcast. I still think about it, you know, having a trial to determine if God is real or not. The Ray Wise villain of that film. God, you know, you hope for movies like that when you're in the content creation game. But this movie, I'm not surprised that it was a box office failure, because the whole tone of it, the whole message of it, the whole spirit of it was actually moving away in a lot of ways from the spirit of that previous movie. It was actually much less about owning the libs than it was about healing divides. And I don't know, like, given that it came out, you know, in 2018, height of the Trump era, you can imagine the sort of discordant note that this movie would have struck with its target audience. So I hope to God the next one leans a little bit more. The pendulum swings in a different direction.
Yeah, I can't answer to the fourth movie because I have not seen it, although I believe Jeanine Pirro has a starring role in that movie where she just has a cameo in this one. That one is about Common Core standards, though, so I don't know.
Hell yeah.
Critical race theory, I hope.
But no, I think the first two are genuinely campy and excellent. They look maybe worse than anything else I've ever seen. There's no blocking. Like, no one involved knows how to compose a shot. We were talking about the wine scene in the first one, but it's just like the most static thing you've ever seen. And everything is like clearly filmed in Airbnbs.
Yes. There's a porny look to a lot of these movies, you know?
Yeah. And in that scene, it's just like, there's all of that. And then meanwhile, what you're seeing on screen is like Kevin Sorbo quoting Descartes while like Ein Klein Nacht music plays in the background to let you know that this is a posh liberal setting.
They're both great. They're fun. They're stupid. The premise of both of them is so insane. Like, one is about a debate about God in a college classroom where a professor says he will fail a student if he doesn't sign a pledge saying that God is dead. The second one literally puts the premise on trial. And this one just sucks. I mean, the basic plot is that Pastor Dave, a supporting character in the first two movies, who's now taken on a starring role. He also runs the film production company that makes these movies. And this feels like a kind of
vanity project.
Yes. And essentially, you know, his school is on a state university and the school wants to turn it into a student center. It gets burned down in a kind of freak accident. And that's the whole plot. Like, John Corbett shows up as the liberal brother who's there to defend him. And there's always a token liberal but instead of being convinced that God is great and real, John Corbett just goes back to being a public defender. And like, the movie is weirdly silent in all the culture war stuff. It's just sort of like, what if we were all nice to each other again? And I'm like, fuck that.
Yeah, that's the thing about this movie. Like, I left this movie thinking that I hate the makers of it less than I expected to. For like right-wing evangelical types, they seem quite sincere and not cynical. To make a whole movie built around wanting to heal divides is fairly admirable, you know. But I mean, the filmmaking is every bit as bad as it is in the first two movies. And if it's not even fun, then what are we doing here?
Yeah, it's like, why do even our insane right-wing evangelical movies have to talk about like bipartisanship and compromise? It's is nothing sacred? Like, honestly, I sat down to watch this movie expecting some good old, you know, fire and brimstone evangelical victimhood complex. I mean, I guess that it would be too much to ask for Kevin Sorbo to make another appearance since they killed off the character in the first movie, but something Kevin Sorbo or Kevin Sorbo adjacent would have been nice.
We should also clarify that it wasn't they didn't kill him off. God killed Kevin Sorbo at the end of the first movie for not believing him.
That's right. In like a streak of Old Testament justice, the most vengeful, cold-blooded thing ever, the film just passes over it, and as Kevin Sorbo like bleeds out while we're serenaded by the news boys.
Yeah, God didn't stop the Holocaust, but he took time out of his busy day to kill Kevin Sorbo. They could have brought Kevin Sorbo back as like the twin brother, you know, do a City Slickers 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold kind of thing.
But you know what? I mean, I actually thought at the outset of this film, given how it had begun, that it was going to be sort of more in line with the two films that preceded it, because I'd forgotten the details. Maybe Alex, you can remember them more precisely, but at the end of the second film, Pastor Dave ends up being jailed because he refuses to respond to a subpoena of his sermons. And that's the event that this film opens with. Pastor Dave is let out of prison.
Yes. So he's jailed at the end of the second movie because there is a law that is loosely based on one that was passed in 2008 in Houston, but they quickly backed down on. That was essentially about the Johnson Amendment, which is a law that basically prevents churches from engaging in political activity. It's like why churches can't endorse candidates. It's a weird, like, it's one of those things that's very big in the religious right, but you rarely encounter it anywhere else. Trump has talked about it, of course, as well, our great evangelical president. But yes, the premise of that was that Pastor Dave refuses to comply with a court order that demands his sermons be reviewed by authorities. It's never entirely clear which authorities these are. And again, this is a film that takes place in Arkansas. Like, you know, I mean, I guess in the quote unquote basis for this, that was in Texas, but in Houston, this is very clearly small town Arkansas. I'm not entirely sure what liberal mafia there is there, but he is also in prison, which I don't entirely understand either.
Absolutely nothing about the premise makes sense. I mean, if you look up what is ostensibly the factual basis for it, it doesn't seem like anyone was actually really prosecuted under this law, which concerned the tax code. It didn't exclusively target evangelical preachers. Like, it's just a completely contrived premise. But also, even taking like its lack of a real world grounding for granted, it doesn't make sense as a narrative premise, because why would Pastor Dave's sermons be secret? Pastor Dave, the film series, has like beat us over the head with the idea that Pastor Dave is like a young, cool, like, you know, he's like a rock and roll pastor. He lets you go listen to the Newsboys, probably listen to the Newsboys himself. All his sermons would be on YouTube. Like, you don't do sermons like that are secret and private. These are happening at a public university, at a public church. I just don't get it. It doesn't make any sense.
I thought the movie was going to lean more into like the free speech angle, but it kind of drops it really early on and instead becomes a movie about eminent domain, which I think is another reason why this movie didn't resonate even with its target audience. Property rights stuff, maybe that gets some people fired up, but not as much as freedom, you know? Not as much as being able to say what you think.
Yeah, there's an odd thing to it where it actually sidesteps the question of religious controversy, more or less. Like, so basically, a student is angry because essentially his girlfriend has dumped him for Jesus, and he throws a brick through a window, which severs a gas line.
A Rube Goldbergian chain of events leads to this child killing a visiting priest from Africa and burning the church.
Completely burns the whole thing down. That means that the church is, you know, it's not structurally sound anymore. And the college is like, well, let's just destroy it and build the student center there. But no one is like, I mean, some of the people on the board are like, we need to get these religious fanatics out of here. But for the most part, they're just like, I'll just build a student center. Who cares anymore? Which is, one, seems reasonable. But two, in the first two movies, Pastor Dave has been a font of controversy, been around for all the stuff. I think it's completely reasonable for them to seize the opportunity to wash their hands of this guy.
This film, I completely agree. This film cannot make up its mind. What is the university's motivation for attacking the church? It seems to be both a kind of unprincipled, like, opposition on dogmatic, secularist grounds, like, we must purge religion and persecute the Christians. But then the film doesn't really, like, it kind of half represents it as that. And then the other half of it is just like, oh, it's prime land. They want to build a student center. It's become embarrassing for the university. So it's kind of a PR crisis because, yeah, Pastor Dave is a lightning rod of controversy. And that kind of ambiguity definitely robs a film of, like, the juice that I was expecting. And if I'm sitting down to watch a film like this, what I really want is some juice.
With all due respect, if we kick the church off campus now after what just happened, how do you think that's going to look?
We're going to look bad, no matter what we do. But in the long run, this is what's best for the students.
Okay. Tom, I think you should be the one to talk to Reverend Dave.
Dave is my friend.
Let's maybe get into the plot in a little more detail. Obviously, the film begins with Pastor Dave getting released from prison. There's then, you know, this idea that they're going to shut down the church and build a student center. But we haven't discussed the other instigating event of this film. And this is where, you know, I think all of these films have had some kind of a romance plot in them, or at least the first one did. And this is where that comes in. And I have to say, this is where, like, most of the comedy in the movie came from, because, you know, it's very typical dynamic for these films where Adam, the boyfriend, you know, he's a skeptic. He's kind of like Kevin Sorbo was in the first film. And Keaton, who the film is more sympathetic to, you know, she's a believer. She's having a bit of a crisis of faith, but she's nonetheless still attached enough to her faith that she breaks up with Adam because he keeps, I don't know, deriding it. And because she's sitting around, and this was to me, the funniest scene in the movie. She's sitting around with a bunch of these skeptics and they're discussing. I've already forgotten. Are they literally discussing the Berenstain Bears thing? Or like Curious George, right? And what is the Curious George equivalent of the Berenstain Bears?
He had a tail and then it went away, I think.
Yeah, so in the scene, they're all sitting around and they're discussing, I don't know, these various kind of like widespread misconceptions. I couldn't remember if they were discussing the one about we all thought it was the Berenstain Bears, but it's actually the Berenstain Bears. Yeah, like learning that the Kit Kat bar doesn't have a hyphen in the name is apparently enough to send Keaton into like existential turmoil and like cause her to nearly abandon her faith. Like, that's how she experiences the silence of God. It's like, if there's no hyphen in the Kit Kat, I just don't know what to believe anymore. But she nonetheless breaks up with Adam, and then he, in a fit of being pissed off, throws a brick through the church window, and that's how the film gets started.
Yeah, and it burns down the church, but it also sets off a chain of event that ends up killing Pastor Dave's friend, who was in the basement at the time, who turns on a light, starts a fire, and dies. Reverend Jude, because they always say, "Hey, Jude." That's how I remember it. And then from there, it's basically eminent domain. John Corbett, he's actually, I think, pretty good in this.
I agree. I also like John Corbett in this movie. I think he has a kind of like wry sense of humor as well as gravitas. I don't know. And I thought he had chemistry, frankly, with Pastor Dave. So one of the pleasant surprises of this film.
Which is basically impossible because he's a terrible actor and a completely wooden screen presence, and yet every time Corbett's there as his liberal non-believer brother, the movie kind of lights up a little bit, and he is playing it like the first two movies.
That is something I've come to appreciate about this franchise in particular, the fact that sometimes they'll get actual professional actors in them. Like Ray Wise is kind of good in the last one, you know.
Yeah, Sabrina the Teenage Witch was in the previous movie.
Tatum O'Neill has a very small part in this.
Yeah. Although I was a little disappointed by Tatum O'Neill. I thought she was going to be the mustache twirling villain, and I just didn't think there was enough there for her to work with.
No, and it should have been that they wanted to tear down the church because they like hate religion or whatever. Mm-hmm. But instead, no one says anything. And weirdly, I mean, I think that's a movie that Pastor Dave was reading the reviews, maybe, or David White, the guy who makes these movies, because it's very conscious of the criticisms of these movies. It directly addresses the stuff about how it's all, you know, Christian persecution, complex BS, quite aggressively. There's a point in it where Pastor Dave keeps going to this black church, I guess because his church is on fire, and he's like complaining about how Christians are being oppressed, and like the pastor there is just like, "Hey brother, like I'm a black priest in the South."
The line is, "I could build a church for you with all the bricks that have been thrown through my window." By the way, either I'm missing something here, or this is just like the kind of bonkers thing you find in a movie like this, but like, why were there a number of fluent Swahili speakers at this church? That does not seem likely or accurate. Or is it just some type of church where we would expect that? When Pastor Dave's friend dies, he says a bunch of words in Swahili over and over again that Pastor Dave doesn't understand. And then a couple at this church explains what they mean. And I'm already forgetting. It's just something like, "God is great because God is good," or "God never stopped being great," or something like that.
Yeah, there's another scene too where Pastor Dave and his quasi girlfriend to watch a guy carving like African sculptures too, and it's never explained or addressed in any way. It's just kind of there.
Okay, well, we're jumping ahead in the plot, but I have to say, this sequence with the sculptures, I did register it, and I was clapping like a fucking seal when it was going on, and then as soon as it finished, I was like, "Will, I'm gonna retract my endorsement of this scene if they reference it again." Like, if the film doesn't just allow this to pass as like a little moment of unexplained but nonetheless potent subtlety, I hate it. And then, yeah, sure enough, the film had to reference it later.
I was just thinking about that sculptor chiseling away at that rock. It's okay to be broken, Dave. It means God's still shaping you.
But I did kind of like the scene because, yeah, Pastor Dave and Meg, who works at the local diner and, yeah, really has the hots for earnest Christian pastors who stick it to temporal and secular authorities. They're going through a park and they're talking about faith. And there's this guy carving a sculpture, but then there's like a finished sculpture next to it. And she points to one and says, "Isn't it amazing, you know, he can look at that," pointing to the one that's unfinished, "and see that," pointing to the one that is finished. And I kind of like this as this little like flourish of abstract thought in the, you know, film series, where I think you'd both agree that is not its strong suit. I kind of thought that what this was is like, it's supposed to be a metaphor for creation. It's like there was chaos, there was nothingness. And like within that, God was able to sculpt meaning, and then the faithful were able to find meaning and partake in it in the world that God created. But I don't think that that is what the film actually meant by this after all, because when it's referenced later, you know, I'm already forgetting what exactly Meg says, but yeah, it's just some dumb thing. I've already forgotten it.
I literally finished this movie 45 minutes ago and I like have forgotten most of it.
Well, returning to the Pastor Dave, John Corbett plot, another like relatively tasteful thing the movie does is, as you mentioned earlier on, Alex, it does not end up converting the John Corbett character. Much of the movie is sort of built on their relationship. I mean, what's not really convincing about the relationship is there are a lot of times when Pastor Dave, like he has a bit of a chip on his shoulder about his brother. They're estranged. And there's one part where he gets angry. He said, admit it, you came here to watch me fail. I've always been in your shadow, you know, that kind of thing, which doesn't really ring true since, you know, for years, Pastor Dave seems to have been operating pretty successfully as a preacher. And also, John Corbett has come here basically working pro bono to help his brother. He seems to have come pretty selflessly.
I do like how Pastor Dave becomes like angry and based at a number of moments in the movie. He is such an earnest character. And actually, I said to Will going into this movie, like knowing very little about it except that it's centered on Pastor Dave, I was like, you know, I kind of like Pastor Dave. I don't want the culture war to ruin Pastor Dave. And then sure enough, the film actually kind of reflects like the earnestness of the character. Like Pastor Dave is like the one character throughout these movies who's seemed to actually live up to the, I don't know, archetype of the, like the image of kind of the, you know, tolerant evangelical in this world that these films want to claim like all evangelicals are, but in practice, like most of them are just like angry and have this victimhood complex. So Pastor Dave remains pretty earnest in this movie and is, you know, pretty earnest at the film's conclusion as well. But he gets really pissed off and we see this different side of him. And yeah, he like attacks Adam for throwing a brick through the window of the church when he finds out.
I want to talk about a couple of things. One is that this is Pastor Dave's death wish movie. He is basically for like half the movie is on a weird violent tear. He attacks the college dean at one point, who he is
yes.
who is engaged in a lawsuit with, which I guess that technically the dean attacks him, but whatever. Like a judge would frown on this. He literally attacks a child, a student. In his defense, he thinks that this guy murdered his friend. But that also is confusing to me because like they have forensic investigators, right? Like they would have figured out what happened to this guy pretty quickly and that he was not murdered by an assailant, that he died via this bizarre train of events that led to the fire. But yet the fact that this kid is also worried that people think he's a murderer and he's like, oh, it was an accident. But you're like, that's still manslaughter. Like,
yeah,
this kid, yeah. I don't want to be pro-carceral, which I am not. But the movie really like washes its hands of the fact that this kid started a chain of events that did result in somebody dying. Like, he's dead because he threw a brick through the window.
I think the movie maybe overplays its hand by having somebody die. Like, if he just burned the church down.
I feel like Adam's kind of like the crisis he has from throwing the brick is more about how he's not sharing a secret. Like it's more about like the guilt that comes with dishonesty. It's not about like the guilt from he killed someone. And that is very strange.
If you're like looking at your phone and you run someone over with your car, you don't mean to do it, but they're dead. And like you go to jail for that. Like,
well, the movie's treatment of the visiting pastor suggests its problems with, you know, race. I hate to read the movie in bad faith, but that visiting pastor is obviously there to establish that, you know, Pastor Dave is cool with black people. I know what you think about Christian conservatives, but hey, we're not racist. He has a galaxy of black friends here. But the way that the movie so casually disposes of that character, his death is just the instigating incident. And then after he's gone, he's not entirely mourned. Like you're right that the problem is more that this kid is holding a secret than that he's killed a man.
Yeah. And then you're like, later on, he's talking to his girlfriend and it's like, oh, well, I'm mad because the church, my mom was getting beat up by her husband and the church was mean about her getting a divorce, which is a reasonable reaction. But the movie then uses that to be like, you know, it's like, well, not all Christians are good, which is, I think, true and reasonable. Not what I want from a God's Not Dead movie, first of all. And two, also, like, still doesn't really excuse the fact that you killed the guy. Also, manslaughter, I just looked it up, Arkansas, that's 3 to 10.
Right.
He's going away.
I also enjoyed the fact that after Keaton breaks up with Adam, and Adam just, like, can't handle this, he totally breaks down. And yeah, he gets so pissed off that he throws a brick through the church window. She's sort of like, I need space. And then, like, throughout the movie, they constantly seem to be just, like, hanging out and having these long-winded conversations about faith and belief. And it's like, buddy, just leave her alone.
Yeah, and she also is, like, she's not an accessory, but, you know, he does confess pretty quickly and she's like, yeah, you shouldn't tell anybody.
Yeah. Like,
that's not in the spirit of this at all. In general, right, there's like a real insecurity in this movie that is not present in the first two, because the first two are really just gung-ho, like, God is alive and he's great, and if you like accept it, then that's great, but if you don't, then you're like an evil lib and you should probably be in prison until
God will kill you, and God will kill you. And in fact, the first two don't make space for the idea that maybe somebody can actually be an atheist based on rational grounds. Like, the Kevin Sorbo character is revealed to not really be an atheist, he's just mad at God. but this movie gives the John Corbett character that space.
Yeah, there's another character, so the Reverend Jude, who is murdered by this child, he is sort of replaced with an assistant who is he seems a little like a Catholic socialist or something almost, and he's like Pastor Dave's buddy, and he has this very, my favorite part of the movie is when he is talking to John Corbett, so he was like, oh, I was going to be a lawyer like you, doing human rights and social justice law, but I decided that the best way to help people is to be an evangelical Christian. And John Corbett's like, but what do you mean? And he says, well, Jesus was the ultimate social justice warrior. And he was
trying to own the libs with their own logic. It's like, well, hey, you like diversity? You're down with women? Well, hey, so was Jesus. Back when women couldn't even testify at a trial, he took their opinions seriously. Checkmate, liberals.
And this character, of course, is none other than Josh Wheaton, the star of the first movie. I was happy to see him again. I was very happy in an earlier scene where he starts talking about how he studied property law and the university can use eminent domain to expropriate the land on which the church sits. Eminent domain, right-wing people love talking about eminent domain so much. It's right up there with how we should go back to the gold standard and like any other number of esoteric things that you only ever hear about from certain kinds of conservatives but are totally ubiquitous in their circles. But yeah, this scene that you guys are talking about is absolutely incredible. And this is where the film veers into this kind of like, yeah, weepy and earnest direction that you're not expecting. Because, yeah, Josh Wheaton says, you know, Jesus was the ultimate social justice warrior. And I think standing up for the oppressed doesn't have a political agenda. So this film series, I feel like, has really veered in a quite different and unexpected direction with the third installment. Because, like, it's not about pedantically proving the existence of God through, like, science and reason, or, like, invoking a certain bogus right-wing idea of free speech or whatever. Like, now it's about telling its audience, you're actually good people, and your identity, your political tribe has always been on the right side of history. Like, you were marching with Dr. King, you support equality for everybody, and that's not even political. That's just, you know, you're just good people.
Well, what the movies have in common is a sort of pedantic insistence that evangelical Christianity can and should work for everyone. And the first two movies are doing a very sort of science and reason approach. But this movie wants to make Christianity fit in with everyone's political persuasion. And it's using facts and logic to do that. You know, Alex, I don't know if you've heard of these movies, but Luke and I have covered a couple of movies that were made in the Deep South in the 70s, starring this preacher called Estes W. Perkle. And the first one was called If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do? And the second one was called The Burning Hell. And that one, it is exclusively and entirely about how if you do not accept Christ, you will go to hell and it will be really bad. And he offers no proof. He doesn't bother with any of this pedantic facts and logic shit. He says, no, there's this book and it explains that if you don't take Christ, you'll be in hell and you'll be there for a billion years times a billion years times a billion years and you'll be in pain for every second of it. So repent now. That's the extent of its thought. Estes Perkel does not care about facts and logic. He's much more urgent than that. He cares about saving your damn soul right now. He doesn't have time for that.
The thing I think is interesting about these movies is the first two are in some ways belated responses to the rise of new atheism, I think. And they're the first one in particular, but they're both obsessed with this growth of like Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris types who are using the
facts and logic.
Yeah, cold logic of atheism. And this one is more interesting to me in that I think it is a sort of post-Trump, post-Woman's March, but I think it also predicts to some extent the growth of what we would soon call wokeism or the social justice warrior movement. And it's trying to do something similar where it's like those two movies are trying to meet new atheists on their own turf and be like, oh, you guys want to wrestle with proofs? Well, we'll go toe to toe with you. And this is just like, oh, well, let us talk about the language of the oppressed and Christians are oppressed, but like so are other people. And it's okay if you don't want to do that. But also Jesus is like a really sweet guy and he's nice. And like, maybe that'd be okay with you. It's all right. It's fine. And it feels like one, like a huge cop out. But I think that the thing that's strange about these films is that at least the first one is trying to do two things at once, which is like appeal to a evangelical Christian audience while doing a form of ministering to people who might not be Christians. And in this, you're just like, well, I don't know what the hell you're even trying to do here, but it isn't satisfying in any of those different categories.
Yeah. And I mean, the other thing this movie partakes in that we've alluded to already is, yeah, this very sort of like, why can't we all get along and do bipartisan solutions and compromise? One of the things I really did like in this film, which, you know, we've seen in the first two as well, was like when they do these fake news segments, this is the major expository device these films use, is kind of fake news panels. I mean, they kind of resemble real ones, but are somehow like even more ridiculous, hyper real versions of what cable news panels are actually like. And throughout the movie, a number of the talking heads on those panels will say things like, isn't this whole controversy just emblematic of our age where everybody's talking and yelling and nobody's listening?
Said by Jeanine Pirro of Fox News, one of the ultimate yellers, like maybe the biggest yeller on Fox.
I mean, I don't have a satisfactory explanation for that. I mean, what you were just saying, Alex, makes perfect sense about the first two films as a response to new atheism. And of course, to a certain extent, we're now just like all of us, whether we're like right-wing evangelicals or anyone else, are living in the world that new atheists kind of created. Like, or, you know, everybody on the right argues like new atheists now. It's all facts and logic bullshit. Like, that's what the intellectual dark web, so-called, was all about. Like, everything is just fucking Ben Shapiro now. And, you know, the fire and brimstone kind of stuff that didn't bother with facts and logic, maybe in some ways more sinister, but it was also in some ways more fun. But I would be curious if either of you can offer, because I really can't, a satisfactory explanation for why this movie is trying to do like, let's use our indoor voices kind of stuff. Like, why would an evangelical film that came out in 2018 be doing that at all? I don't get it.
I think somebody told Pastor Dave, or he gleaned from the reviews, that these movies were preaching to the choir. I'm actually willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. I think he took that seriously and thought some of this culture war stuff is really getting in the way of spreading the message. And if that is right, then, you know, I have to tip my hat to him. There's something admirable and not cynical about that.
I think that that's exactly right, which is why the movie's so boring. I think
that's also why it bombed at the box office.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it still did better. It made $7.1 million, which is still seven times as much money as God's Not Dead 4, but it is four times less. Less than God's Not Dead 2, and I think 10 times less than the first installment. It would not shock me if this movie was conceived in 2016. It feels of a piece of culture that emerged when like the Trump coin was still being flipped in the air. And I think for evangelicals in particular, I think you can sense a kind of like wariness with this and where it's going and a reluctance to like go all in, which I think was certainly present for a little bit until they got their judges and stuff. one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by the first two is that, so when you like do polling with voters, they're always just like, we love bipartisanship. Like, we just want Republicans and Democrats to work together. But when you talk to actual voters, what they mean is, what they want is for Republicans and Democrats to come together to do whatever the hell it is that they want. And it's usually almost always weird, unpopular shit. And the first two movies of this are great because like, they're basically that. They're just like, yeah, no, we should all just come together and agree that the evangelical Christians are right. And this movie ends in a totally different place where it's like, no, it's kind of real, not bipartisanship, but it's sort of just like, well, what if we all just like turn the temperature down a little bit and like hung out together and stopped screaming? And it sort of makes an earnest case for that while also still being like, but also you have to accept Jesus Christ into your heart.
Well, yeah. And like, a problem is, as is so often the case when this like meta issue of using our indoor voices comes up, the movie doesn't spend a lot of time on the thing itself. At the end of the movie, when Pastor Dave goes to, you know, the remains of the church, and he walks through these two crowds of pro-Christ and anti-Christ protesters, I guess. Like, what exactly are they picketing? Are they picketing eminent domain? Are they picketing the separation of church and state? Are some there because they're angry at what they perceive as a hate crime? It's never really specific.
In some ways, the movie is, I think, accidentally very clear-eyed about the way that the right-wing, like, outrage economy works, and that essentially there is no precipitating crime, and, like, everyone involved mostly just kind of doesn't want to deal with this church anymore. And yet it immediately ignites this massive culture war storm in which everyone is pissed off all the time, but can't entirely explain why. So I was kept pausing. One of the things that was interesting is what the sign said. So one sign just said stairway to heaven, which I don't know. The best one just says embrace the fire. And it had, so he just drew a big fire and it had a bunch of skulls. But then there was another one that just said build that wall.
Right.
Yeah. And a fourth one that said, there's one that said something
Medicare
about
Medicare for all.
There's one that says the church is affordable care for the brain, I think. Which
God's like AI so this generated. Is,
yes. Basically, it's basically the end of Jon Stewart's Irresistible. That's what the end of this movie is. And I mean, just point of information, the sign that says embrace the fire, is that like a pro or anti Pastor Dave message? Is that like embrace the fire, the unbelievers will burn in the fires of hell? Or is that like embrace the fire and then the skulls are supposed to be like pagan symbols and so it's anti-Christian? Like, what is going on?
Or maybe embrace the message sent by the fire that engulfed this church and close it down.
Too many levels for me, man.
The whole world knows what the church is against, but it's getting harder and harder to know what it's for.
Seems like you're the one much is being asked of this time.
So, I mean, we should summarize the actual ending of the film, which, as we've been discussing, I think...
huge letdown.
Yeah, huge letdown. Threw us all for a curveball. After seeking God's help in church through prayer, Dave eventually realizes that his case has only made things worse and that St. James is not the right church for God and his followers. He drops his lawsuit, reaches an out-of-court settlement with the college, and after talking with a repentant Adam, he goes to see Adam in the Slammer, and consulting with Jude's family, ultimately asked to have the criminal charges against Adam dropped. Dave then announces to his college protesters that while St. James will be torn down, he will reopen a new church not far from the school.
Well, it's interesting that the sort of spiritual successor to this franchise was probably Sound of Freedom, not explicitly an evangelical film, but it was one that was more than any other of these sorts of movies in the Trump era was really tuned in to the vibe of the Trump era. You know, these movies are really like facts and logic stuff. The temperature of that was moved on to, no, there are pedophile elites everywhere and they will kidnap and molest your children and we have to stop them right now. So I feel like if the God's Not Dead franchise is to sort of reclaim its place, it's going to have to go with a more kind of QAnon message like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways this movie betrays the weird post-Hillary moment in right-wing or Republican politics, and that there's a sort of Hillary Clinton-sized hole on the enemies list after she was vanquished at the Javits Center. And this movie, instead of just inventing one or just being like the libs, basically just kind of hand waves it. And it's just like, man, maybe everything's just going to be fine. And I think, yeah, the success of QAnon as you guys did that like last year, right? Sound of Freedom.
Literally one of the weirdest film screenings I've ever been to. But I have to take issue with Will's characterization of The Sound of Freedom as right wing, because I don't see how standing up for victims of child trafficking has a political agenda.
Amen, brother.
Jesus was the ultimate social justice warrior.
You forget that QAnon, when this was at least being filmed, was like relatively nascent. Trump was there, obviously, but like the enemies list was sort of whoever Trump hated all the time. And it was before things had really started to gain their own sense of logic or momentum. And this feels oddly, yeah.
The next one should be about Sissy Graydon Carter and how his Vanity Fair Oscar party is no longer hot.
I mean, that would be great, though. Like, that would be a good movie. Like, I want to see that. I don't want to see this shit about Common Core.
You know, that gives me perhaps another possible interpretation of God's Not Dead 3. You know, and like, I guess it would depend on like what was the actual genesis of it. Was it 2016? Was it conceived in 2017? I'm not sure. But perhaps there's a reading of it where, given that it comes out in 2018, what all the sort of, I don't know, like wishy-washy stuff, earnest stuff in the movie is actually about is that, you know, it's still early enough in the Trump presidency, at least at conception, the film, that, you know, these people are feeling great. They feel like they're in a position of strength because they've vanquished, yeah, like the demon Hillary Clinton, and like God Emperor Trump is in the White House and, you know, he's going to lock her up or whatever. And QAnon, I think like the way we have to understand it is that it's a reaction to the thwarted dreams, in a sense, of certain people who put their faith in the Trump presidency. I mean, this is really Will Summers' thesis on QAnon in his big book on it, Trust the Plan, is that there were a huge number of people, like hardcore MAGA heads, many of them right-wing evangelicals, you know, whether practicing or not, like very much people from that milieu who kind of inherited its ontologies and its belief systems, or, you know, kind of cleaved to them in some way. They thought that Donald Trump was going to solve all their problems, like not just in the kind of abstract political sense, but like in the literal personal sense. Donald Trump was going to be in the White House and he was going to, you know, abolish all of their medical debt or whatever. Like there's a whole host of things like that that Will chronicles in his book. And, you know, that is what QAnon is all about. It's a register of when prophecy fails, in a sense. So maybe God's Not Dead 3 captures a moment for the Christian right where they're actually feeling pretty relaxed and in a position of strength, so much so that they can make a fucking stupid movie like this.
More like God's dead, if you ask me, right, guys? Yes.
I texted all of my family members, God's dead, after finishing this.
And then, yeah, the credits roll. There's a remix of the God's Not Dead, He's Surely Alive song from the previous movie. And then if you stay to the end, you will see Newsboys member Michael Tate. I can't remember which instrument he plays. He tells you to text God's Not Dead, hashtag God's Not Dead, and to download the app, which, of course, I duly did.
Do you have the app in front of you? Can you show us like what some of the games and fun little doohickeys and doodads, what does it do? Can you hook up with sexy singles in your area?
That'd actually be great. It basically just tries to push you towards people that are arguing for the scientific evidence of God. It sells the books and the movies, the books being the human right to know Jesus Christ and to make him known, Man, Myth, Messiah, Answering History's Greatest Question, and God's Not Dead, the evidence behind the hit movie God's Not Dead.
Can you imagine being the sort of dork who would actually go over the evidence of God's Not Dead?
But it's crazy. I mean, it is just like they've built like a really shitty fan culture around this movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's a thing that's like Meet the Experts, and most of them are, in fact, the expert witnesses from the trial in the second movie. Some of our friends like
Sorry, the experts are the fictional characters from the
In the trial, they had some actual, it was like blurring the line between documentary and fiction, because they had some actual like writers and journalists in the trial, people who wrote books. Like there was that guy who had a book like A Cold Case for Christ, like a guy who worked in the police for 30 years doing cold cases and applied all of his facts and logic to look at the crime scene of Jesus.
Oh yeah, he applied like modern forensics to conclude conclude that the resurrection was true or whatever.
Yeah, I don't know if he went over to the Middle East and was taking soil samples or whatever. I don't know how you do that.
The app really is a disappointment, because there's also something called the God test you can click on. And I was hoping that we could all do the God test on mic, but unfortunately, if you click on it, it tries to make you download another app. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at the God test app, and the first question on it is, do you believe in God? Yes or no? And question number two is, how would you describe God? Loving, holy, impersonal force, in parentheses, energy, uninvolved, or other?
Oh, wow. I'm going to go with other. I think God is love.
Okay, I will write God is love.
Yes. Yes.
So are we doing this? We're doing the test? Do you have it?
Yeah, I have it right now.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Let's have some more. This is a great way to finish this off.
Permission to include your responses in our research. I'm sure that this is highly scientific. I will say yes. Yeah. Question one, do you believe in God?
I'm going to say no, honestly.
Okay. I think we need to say no to elicit like the good response. So let's do it.
Yeah. Okay, so we went over question two, which we're putting God is love for. Question three. Oh, no, there's question two again. What are the main reasons you don't believe in God? Conflict with science, evil and suffering, lack of evidence, multiple religions, or other?
All of the above. Can I go with all of the above? A lot of good reasons in there.
All right, I'm going to write all of the above. Question three. Why is there something rather than nothing? Always existed, created itself. Laws of physics, no idea, or other.
I don't know. Can you just write the dinosaurs and see if that confuses it?
Sure, I will do that. Question four. Do you find any ultimate purpose or meaning in the universe? Yes, no, uncertain.
I would say uncertain. I've never been more uncertain about anything in my life, in fact.
Question five. How do you account for the origin of life? Chance, laws of nature, extraterrestrial origins, uncertain, or other? I'm going to put extraterrestrial origins.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, whatever. Let's just have fun.
That seems fun. Question six.
In a way, God is the ultimate extraterrestrial when you think about it.
That's right. Steven Spielberg made a movie about it. Yeah. Question six. Does evil exist? Yes, no, or uncertain?
Yes. Can I answer for both of us on that? I think evil exists.
Yeah, that seems good.
But they're going to throw a curveball now. They're going to say, without objective morality, how can there be evil? That's the next question. I can see it coming a mile away.
Actually, pretty close. What is the basis of your morality? No basis, social norms, evolution, feelings, the Godzilla franchise? No, it's other.
Again, put the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs.
Question eight. Do you think human life is special compared to animal or plant life?
Yeah, let's say no, just again to...
I think it's more special than plant life, at least, you know? And sorry if that's racist to say, but I think we are better than plants.
Yes. I'm going to put uncertain, but I'll put we're better than plants.
Thank you.
equal with most animals.
Yeah.
Better than some.
I'm not against the elimination of all hierarchy, and if that makes me counter-revolutionary, then I'll take that.
Question nine, how certain are you that God does not exist? Scale of 1 to 10.
You answer this one, Luke. How uncertain are you?
Well, I don't know. It's like, I think the fun answer is 10, or maybe just the dinosaurs.
you can't submit that. Zero is weirdly not an option here, but.
So wait, one is what is most uncertain?
Well, I think 10 would be full certainty in the non-existence of God.
Oh, five. Let's say five.
Yeah, that sounds good to me.
The most uncertain one I can pick. Yes.
I don't want to go to hell for this too, so it seems good to start hedging at some point.
Yeah, like who's collecting the data? Is it the Almighty himself? Because that will affect my answers.
Question number 10, would you like to discuss the theistic responses to these questions? Yes or no?
Nope.
It's a big no.
Is there a 10 for no?
Yeah, you've completed the test. What would you like to do next? Learn more or end test?
End test. Give me a big button that says end test right now.
Yes, and we're done. That's it. It gives you no information. So I don't know if we passed the God test or not.
I thought it was going to like put us on a chart of you are this character from the God's Not Dead franchise.
Dude, it's a real wasted opportunity to at least get some, you know, people who missed circa 2012 BuzzFeed on board with evangelical yeah. Christianity.
See a revolution somehow. Now I'm lost in your freedom, and this world I've overcome. Whoa. My God's not dead, he's surely alive. He's living on the inside. Hide.
Hallelujah.
My faith is.